I'm Chris Hewitt, and welcome to the latest in our series of Empire Podcast spoiler specials. This one is dedicated to the bullet fest that is John Wick Chapter 2. Oh, yes. A little squee there from Helen O'Hara. And here today to join me in discussing this movie, Helen O'Hara, as you heard.
Hello.
I wrote the Empire Review. 4 stars. And James Dyer.
Hello.
Hello, how are you all?
James was on set.
I wasn't.
James
That's
was
very
on set.
True.
I keep forgetting that. Yes.
Okay. I also had forgotten that.
Yes. Well, this is good. We will get into that. We will get to James' memories of his set visit, which have lodged themselves in his brain. It must have been a cracker.
Oh, it was.
We'll get into that later on. And obviously, as ever, it's a spoiler special. So if you have not seen John Wick Chapter 2, then hide thee to your nearest cinema. Oh, or maybe your nearest Continental Hotel, which I believe has a screening room. Check out the movie and then come back, because we will be discussing the film in spoilerific detail, including third act stuff. And I was going to say the deaths, but I don't think we have enough time to cover all the deaths in this movie, which has a phenomenally high body count. Mm. But first, James and Helen here had the pleasure of interviewing the film's director, Chad Stahelski, who was co-director of the first movie, along with David Leitch. And what's his name? Oh, that guy. He's got the beard and the hair. Yeah. Oh, Keanu Reeves. That's right. Keanu Reeves himself. They were in London last week. James and Helen went along to them. And once again, were drenched in spoilers by the end of it. You should have seen their faces. So much fun. So do enjoy these spoiler-filled interviews with Chad Stahelski first, and then Keanu Reeves. Enjoy.
Keanu Reeves, welcome to the Empire Podcast.
Thank you. Nice to be here. Nice to meet you.
How are you?
I'm doing all right today in London town.
So well, we loved the film, first of all. We genuinely loved it.
Thank you. Great.
Where to even begin? Yeah. I'm just going to jump in with my favorite set piece in the film.
All right.
Which is you and Common taking silent pot shots at each other while walking. Which is just genius.
It's delightfully ridiculous.
And no one notices it. Absolutely.
No, I mean, I think, so what's happening is Common, the fantastic Common is playing a peer of John Wick's. He's an assassin. And he's trying to kill me because I killed someone he's taken care of. And so we're going in through the subway, you know, and we start, you know, with silencers, start shooting bullets at each other. And as you say, people aren't noticing. But I think that's kind of what the John Wick tone is. Mm-hmm. You know, like the criminals are actually like in this whole, they're almost not even seen by them. They're like in this separate hyper world.
Yeah. It is. It's quite a huge criminal society we begin to see in this film. Like, I was genuinely asking Chad just now how the economy supports quite so many assassins, because it's
well, they're all third party. You know, they're independent contractors. There's no health and welfare, health benefits. There's no retirement funds. They're just fighting for themselves.
Yeah.
There are so many. So, I mean, from the flash mobs.
There's a lot of work, I guess.
Yeah, I guess. Yeah.
There's a lot of people that need to get done in.
Speaking of the killings, Chan was saying that it was your idea to modify the Gianna hit into what it ultimately became, which is a fascinating sequence.
Yeah.
How did that come into your head? Where did it come from?
I think it was probably influenced from the first film. In the sense of having like the character Marcus, when he kind of fights, you know, he says, "I'll go in my way, I'll go out my own way, sir." And he kind of does this kind of kamikaze, you know, kind of push to be independent. So that I kind of carried into the Gianna character, this idea that she literally says, you know, I do things my way, I'll go out my way. So I think it was more influenced by the ethos of the characters in the world.
Yeah.
And John's like that in a weird way too, right? He's fighting for his independence. And anyway,
you do get the impression from him sometimes that he's so grief-stricken, he would lie down and die if somebody would leave him alone long enough to do that.
Yeah.
But he won't lie down and die for anyone.
Yeah, no, he wants his agency. And I think he feels like he's earned it in some way. I mean, we don't really talk about that, but we certainly go into the idea that there's this John civilian character, grieving husband, and wants to retire and get on the life, and John Wick, the mythical assassin, And I think in that Gianna scene, mm-hmm. I think that's where you see pure John Wick.
Yeah.
Like, that's where you see Il Spectore, Baba Yaga, you know. I mean, I think that guy is scary. But, you know, he has a compassion. And I thought that was an interesting thing in that scene where she does commit, quote-unquote, suicide, and I hold her hand as she's bleeding out in this Roman tub. But I have to shoot her in the head. It's John Wick. I mean, I don't know if you felt like that. Did you go like, of course he has to do that?
It made sense. Yeah.
I was still shocked. I got it, but it's still shocking.
He wouldn't have technically fulfilled the marker unless he'd done it.
Exactly, man.
The marker idea was great. I mean, the gold coins was a level of texture in the first one. And this idea that this is almost sort of a classical analog world, from the sort of 60s call centers to the sort of bloody thumbprints. Mm. I mean, it's incredible texture.
Yeah, it's a fun world to play in. And definitely Chad Stahelski, the director, was influenced by 70s American action movies and also Japanese Kurosawa, and there's some Sergio Leone, but I like all those kind of bits and bobs, the kind of the marker, the gold coins, the hotel, the Continental, that's like a safe haven for assassins and, you know, the nefarious kind. I mean, I think that's what makes it fun. And I'll get the chance to, like, you know, we'll get the chance to explore that more, because I'm sure there's other bits and bobs.
It's really fun. It's a fascinating mix of really civilized society and really uncivilized, super uncivilized.
Yeah, which is delightful.
Yeah.
There are some fantastic exchanges in there, particularly the one with you and Peter Serafinowicz in that almost pornographic sort of gun shopping scene.
Oh, right. Where he's playing, like, we think the sommelier and we think of wine, and then he's like choosing weapons, helping me have a tasting.
Excellent choice.
Excellent choice.
That's
fun.
The way you're kind of holding the guns in there, the way you're sort of looking them over and stuff, very convincing, obviously. Chad talks about you as if you're essentially like a one-man SEAL Team 6 squad.
That's funny.
And we've seen the video of you on the gun range.
Oh, really? Okay.
Fucking terrifying.
No, no, it's target shooting. It's fun. Ping, ping, ping.
You steal. Take this a lot more seriously than, I guess, a lot of your contemporaries. I mean, you seem very...
Well, I don't know about that. I mean, I think I love John Wick, and I love action films, and I love playing the role, and I love that, you know, the director, Chad, is giving me the opportunity to do things that a lot of people don't get the chance to do. They don't have the filmmaker or the story or the tone of John Wick to do all the judo and jiu-jitsu and mix that with guns and then have some knives and then maybe use a garrote and then, you know, maybe hit someone with a car and... Am I forgetting anything? A pencil.
Probably.
Yeah. And then do a pencil fight. I mean, you could do anything with Wick. And for me, I really think of myself as being the limit. Like, Chad can go farther. He has his dreams, his concepts, but he can only do as much as I can do, you know? So I feel really responsible.
Were there any sort of specifically logistically challenging sequences? I mean, in the first one, obviously the Red Circle scene was amazing, and you were sick at the time when you had a fever. I mean, was there anything in this that was particularly difficult to pull off, apart from all of it?
I mean, the sequence with Common, the fight that they have on the streets of Rome, was really technical in the sense of the transitions of the jiu-jitsu, having a pistol, then having a knife, and then wrestling with that, and then doing a reload while you're, you know, fighting, and the intensity of it, and the moves. So Common was cool. I mean, he really committed to John Wick action, because that's a whole other thing. And he was excited for that. So he put the hours in. And so I'd film for like 12 hours. He'd be, you know, training. And then we'd go, we'd train then too. And he came for like a month before we started filming. Wow. So I'd say that sequence, you know, the stuff in the catacombs was pretty, because it's just also kind of attrition, right? Because you're fighting 12 hours a day. And when you get to day five, you know, it's like, okay, more coffee, more coffee, eat more, eat, you know.
Yeah.
But I love it. I love when it's intense. And they did put me in a car to crash into another car that I was a little surprised at. You know, I was like, really, Chad? He's like, yeah, just go. And so, like, drive backwards. It's that scene where he gets all hit by all those cars and he drives backwards, and it's one shot. And you just see me, like, blast into that guy. Oh, yeah, and the one where I go forward and hit that other guy. I pulled the wheel off, the steering wheel off the car when I hit that other car. The impact was so hard, like, and I ripped the steering wheel off in my hand. It's fun.
Is it wrong that in that sequence, like John getting punched, you don't even blink at every time that car got dinged? I was like, oh, God.
Oh, the poor 69.
It seemed like a metaphor for the entire thing, you know. This is what revenge gets you.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, but also, you know, John Wick keeps getting hit. He gets hit by, his car gets hit. He gets hit. He gets shot. He gets stabbed.
The house
burning down, gets blown through glass, I think, 2 or 3 times.
Yeah.
Jumps through glass. It's fun. You knock him down, but he gets back up, right?
Yeah, but more bruises.
More bruises. But then you can go to, you know, Lawrence Fishburne at the Bowery King's place and then just have some surgery and wake up and you're all good to go.
What was that like? Because obviously much was touted that as a kind of unofficial Matrix reunion. I mean, how did it come about that he was there?
Lawrence Fishburne and I are friends. I was at his place. We were catching up on life, as you do. And he mentioned that he liked John Wick. And I was like, really? And he went, yes. And I was like, well, would you be interested in maybe doing something? He was like, send me a script. And so I told Chad, hey, man, Lawrence wants to do this. And he was like, but he wants to read a script. Chad sent the script. Lawrence liked it. And then, you know, he came to play. And it was really a special day when he showed up. It was really something special.
Because that whole sort of homeless network is a whole other level to the mythology.
It's another street level. Yeah. It's ridiculous, but it's fun. But we wanted to open up the world.
Yeah.
I loved by the end of the film as well, you're turning it into a whole kind of 70s paranoia thriller, you know.
Body some of snatchers.
People, yeah, some of those people, it's just their phone is ringing, presumably for an unrelated cause, but he can't be sure at that point.
He can't be sure. It is. I mean, Chad kind of thought about that. I mean, he really did think it was body snatchers and who's real, who isn't. Mm. And I like that he... I like that he's literally running for his life. Yeah. I love it.
Yeah.
Because he's kind of becoming anti-establishment, isn't he? Right?
Yeah.
He broke the rules. I love that scene when John walks into the Continental and McShane, Jonathan, just walk away, Jonathan, and then bang.
Yeah.
What have you done?
What have you done?
I love that. I love it. It's just, what have you done?
Their relationship is fascinating, the whole Winston-Jonathan thing.
Yeah, it's kind of father-sonish, isn't it?
Yeah. You have a real feeling that he would very much be in the ground were it not for Winston's forbearance.
Yes. And he shows his power, right? Mm-hmm. With all those people who stop. And because I deemed it so. I deemed it not to be so. 1 hour.
I was genuinely sitting thinking at that point, 1 hour. How do you get out of Manhattan in 1 hour?
That's escape from New York. I know. Yeah. Well, if we get to, on the first one, we didn't know that that the film would have such affection and that we would have the opportunity. But that being said, we still would talk about what could happen to John because we love the guy. We love the world. And so we did the same on the second one. In chapter two, we were like, so what could happen? You know, so I think the first opening of the film should be Wick just trying to escape from New York, like literally trying to get off the island, you know, and maybe he asks the Bowery King for help. Mm-hmm. And we saw Aurelio, right? John Leguizamo.
Yeah.
Like maybe, you know, Leguizamo comes and helps me out.
He's still trying to fix the car.
Yeah. He's fixing the car, but maybe he's fixing to help John. I can't help you, John. John, I can't do it. You're excommunicado. Really, I got to get off the island. Yeah, it's not my... And then maybe the high table shows up.
Yeah, we were wondering, right?
And then the high table starts firing guns. He's like, what the fuck? And then he's like... And then maybe this kind of thing starts to happen between the high table and Continental. Maybe John is the activator of this confrontation and this perhaps there's a war. Wouldn't that be awesome?
That would be awesome. Because he's broken two things. And he's killed someone on Continental grounds, but that person was a member of the High Table.
Of the High Table.
So he's just fucked everywhere.
He's fucked. He's crazy. He's running. But maybe. Because John is well-loved. It's kind of cool. It's like he's even mythical and scared, but everyone kind of has an affection for the guy.
I started writing down when I was watching all the different nicknames he's given. You know, Baba Yaga, the Il Spectro, and the Devil at one point.
The Devil.
Simply.
Yeah. Do you fear damnation, John? Yes. Yeah.
Amazing. Yeah. Something I'd never seen before. I love the idea of having the body armor sewn into his suit jacket. So he holds up the jacket
to stop the bullets. Yeah, that was a Reevesian invention.
That's amazing.
Yeah, it's fun. Because it allows you to do a lot of different things.
But yeah. Because otherwise you're just assuming no one can shoot.
Yeah. Yeah, no one can shoot and everyone's an asshole. Yeah. I mean, you know, Chad really paid attention to that. I mean, if you ever geek out on the film and you look at where the guns are pointing and where the bullet hits on the walls, they're all technically correct.
Wow. So I think all he needs now is a stab-proof shirt.
I know, right? Like, why isn't he wearing a Kevlar shirt?
Yeah, that was a mistake.
Right?
But
you're thinking right. I mean, you're thinking correct.
I'm just trying to, go through the possible problems here.
Yeah, right.
What else did I want to ask about? Did you have a favorite fight scene?
Guns. I really liked the catacombs in Rome, Caracalla. Fight scene. I gotta pick the Cassian fight scene.
Yeah.
You know, on the streets that just ends up landing in the Continental.
Yeah. Quite lucky. Do you think they were kind of aiming for the Continental?
I think maybe subliminally and unconsciously, because I don't think Wick wants to kill the guy.
Yeah.
And I think there's something about Cassian that he has to kill him, right? As he says, you know how it works. Yeah, eye for an eye. Yeah. Yeah. So, I also like that sequence too where I disembowel the guy. I thought that was cool because I do this cool kind of disengage with a shrug, come behind him, do it, disengage, and then rip that dude. Yeah. And all the gore. Oh, pencil fight.
Pencil fight.
We've been waiting to see how he kills a guy with a pencil.
It's brutal. It's fun. Pencil fight. See, I can't just. It's like ice cream. I want more.
Fantastic.
Well, on that note,
I think we're out of time, Keanu Reeves. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Cheers.
Chad Stahelski, welcome to the Empire podcast, to the Empire John Wick 2 spoiler special podcast.
Great. I just want to hear you say my name one more time.
Oh, you're killing me here. Chad Stahelski?
Good job.
Oh, good man.
First guy on the tour. Okay, good.
Thank you. I'll take that.
Yeah.
So, the thing I would like to start with is the thing that sets John Wick apart for me more than anything else is the mythology of it, the sort of otherworldliness of all of that. How much of that, I suppose, did you have, you and Derek have in your head when you came into the second film, and how much did you think, okay, we had some cool teasers in the first film, now we've really got to think, what does all that mean?
I think the hardest part was definitely the first film. Derek had written the original script. It was a lot more grounded. We still had the gold coins. The Continental was still there. I think that's why the first film has a tad bit more realism. We kept it a little bit more grounded because the script was originally, if this were to exist, the Continental was more of a kind of a sleep easy in Los Angeles, and the gold coin was a holdover from Cold War where you couldn't do denominations, and we had the guy that the Charlie character in the first one, David Patrick Kelly, the guy that comes and cleans up bodies, but it was very, very realistic. Very similar to like the Bourne films, a lot more grounded. And we had decided that we had done so many of those movies in our day job, our second unit, our action director. We'd always been, saturated, grayed out, in an underogatory term, Nolanized, trying to mimic either the Bourne or the Dark Knight kind of thing. And I had a big love of Greek mythology, and Derek had already kind of. I mean, I just read it and went, the palette's there. So it literally took my partner, Dave Leach, and I maybe a conversation or two. Once we had sold the idea to Keanu and the producers, it was like maybe one or two meetings with Derek Cole said to go, look, sounds weird, but we're going to overlap Greek or Roman mythology and try to do this whole subtext or subworld. That's why we did it in New York, because you felt subterranean even though you're on the streets. And I don't know if you've ever been in New York, but you can go for days and not bump into anybody you know or anybody cares that you don't know. So it kind of worked out really well. So once we had that and the first movie, people kind of dug. So it was like, okay, let's kind of recreate the mythology, but let's expand. And that was just a couple trips to New York. And then from that part, it just became kind of open call. You know, we walked around, we saw a lot of the homeless, saw a lot of garbage trucks, saw a lot of street performers, you know, and we just, when you work in film, you're on the road a lot, especially in the States. So we live in hotels all the time. I mean, it's not too much of a stretch that if you consider I've spent more than half my adult life on the road.
Yeah.
Concierge, hotels, the gym, the services in some of the higher and lower end, by the way, hotels just kind of came into our list, and that's kind of when we created the whole continental vibe.
So was the sort of Greek and Roman mythology then the reason why you chose kind of the locations that you did here? I mean, in terms of going to Rome?
Mythic,
and also
yeah.
A lot of the artwork work in the background was a lot of kind of Greek and Roman statues.
Yes, I am a huge fan of benefits of a classical education.
Loving you for quoting Die Hard.
Yeah, tale of wasted youth. I spent a lot of time classical art, classical music, myself an affection for in a weird way. So rather than just do straight classical or straight art, we tried to mix and match, you know, contradictory images with what's being said on screen. I don't know, like, we wanted to make a really fun action movie. It's a genre thing. We get how ridiculous a lot of it is. If you don't get it by the opening shot of Buster Keaton on the wall,
yeah,
we've heard a lot of reviews and like, it's not grounded, it's not real. I don't want to tell you guys, if you didn't get it, then yes, it's a terrible movie, you'll never get it, okay. If you do get it, we wanted something that if you watch over and over again, you're going to pick little things up. And if you're a filmophile or if you're like us, like a big nerd, and you love Sergio Leone or love some of the great action films, 60s, 70s, if you go back and watch that thing, the dialogue, the way they hold the gun, like, you can't miss references to Steve McQueen, to Charles Bronson, to Asian cinema, to Japanese animation. I mean, there's so many references in there. It's like from The Matrix, from the, you know, it's like, we try to make it fun,
yeah.
You know, and people were trying to take it too serious again. It was hilarious.
I loved that opening, by the way. I loved it. So good.
And we thought it was like, for people that hadn't seen the first movie, we didn't want any misconception. We didn't want you to waste a minute of time going, what the hell am I watching? So I figured I'd do some cool aerials, and I pan down, and the first shot is Buster Keaton, sound effects, guy slides off a motorcycle, car comes around, we're playing almost like Taylor Bates, my composer, did, like, look, I just said, whenever the car's on screen, it's a shark. Whenever the motorcycle's on screen, it's a fish. A bump, 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 bump. So, like, I don't know. We all got it. All our friends got it. It's like, as soon as you see it, it's like, okay, I'm in for a wacky movie here. Okay, I'm relaxing. It's not real. Yeah. And then people go, it's not real. No one would ever do that. I'm like, no, yeah, no shit. But I don't know.
You mentioned the homeless earlier on. I found the sort of Lawrence Fishburne mm-hmm. as kind of the head of that kind of almost homeless network. Mm-hmm. That was a really interesting idea. How do you see them fitting into the world of the assassins and the
We just thought it made perfect sense. If you had to be, you know, human intelligence, you know, on the ground. When I was in New York, when we decided we're going to do John Wick 2, I just flew to New York for a week and just walked. Mm-hmm. That's kind of how, I'm not from New York, so it was good to get vested again into the community. You know, unfortunately, there are a lot of homeless looking people there and stuff. But more so than LA or any other city I've been to, they're completely invisible to the populace. And I was like, well, and I started thinking, if I had to be in the John Wick world, it's not a bad way to move around the city. Like, the cops don't care, nobody cares. So we're like, so now when hopefully you see the movie, and like everywhere you walk, you look at the homeless guy, like, well, he could be John Wick, you know. We just thought that was really interesting. So if you had to get around, you had to do thing. It was a whole sub world. So we figured that the Continental was the 5-star. Well, the rich assassins go, there had to be the Motel 6. So we figured that was Lawrence's people. And if you had to reinvent yourself, that'd be a good way to go.
Yeah.
And it's also a tribute to, you know, not going to lie, it's a tribute to the Warriors, that great early 80s movie that Joel Silver did. I've come up with, Joel Silver was a big help in my early career, you know, from The Matrix's on, giving me my first couple action directing jobs. So it was kind of a tribute to all the stuff he did.
I've got to ask, actually, though, because it did occur to me about halfway through, how many assassins can this world support? I mean, because it seems like it's a real growth industry.
Yeah, no, I mean, you know, people, you know, I'm sure you guys will talk about the third act. People got a little like, oh, it's too much. Like, look, it's just people checking it out. You know, it was John Wick. He just killed, you know, more than 100 people. So Winston was just kind of laying down. It was probably everybody in the world was in Central Park for that. Yeah. So I don't see, you know, less than 0.5% of the population, I would hope. But it's like that invasion of the body snatchers thing. You just don't know.
You just don't know. Yeah.
And that's the thing. So like all the people in the final shot of the park and stuff, it's like they're not all assassins. They're just like, it's like that Donald Sutherland, you know, body snatchers thing. You just, maybe this one, maybe that one, maybe the, you just don't know. And that's the whole, I like ambiguity. I don't, you know, we've been asked, or there's some people been annoyed by like, well, why are the gold coins? You didn't explain it. Like, I, you know what? I'm probably not gonna. Their currency. You don't explain the dollar bill. We're not going to explain.
And what is the exchange rate?
Yeah, exactly. It's just like services have a, you know, that's it. It's more of a membership card. If you don't have a gold coin, that's an identifier. Yeah. Yeah. If you pay in gold, they know you're, it's okay. So like it serves two purposes.
That was one of my questions, yeah. Actually, so thank you.
We just kind of went back of like, you know, we always approach it from a realistic point of view, even though it's completely absurd. We get it. But, you know, how would you do it? Like, you know, you don't have to go. I believe in seeing. I love silent movies. And one of the best things you can do, and again, go watch a Spielberg movie. You can watch. And if you turn the volume down, I think he's a genius because you can see a lot of stuff going on. And, you know, you turn down Raiders of the Lost Ark, you still get it. You really do, the way he blocks, the way he shoots. So we were like visual storytelling, Dave and I. So it was just like gold coins, you slide. Like, you know that's an entrance level thing. That's why there's always a shot of the coin. You know by John, he never talks on the phone. He always hangs up on people. He got it. Like, you got it. The audience has seen this kind of movie so many times. Like, you just want to stay ahead of them a little bit. We didn't want to be predictable. We didn't want to be anything like that. And we like ambiguity. Where is John? If we never did a John Wick 3, I like the ending of 2. It's just, how else can this end? There's no happy ending. There's no like, oh, he's going to kill everybody. And be, like, that's a different, those are other action movies.
Yeah.
We're just kind of like, John's that wacky guy.
It's kind of fascinating with him because I feel like if he died tomorrow, he wouldn't be too upset about it. You know, because he is, you
John's
know,
got a little zen to him, yeah.
But at the same time, he's not just going to lie down and let someone else kill him.
It's funny. There's a lot of, and I know he'll shoot me for this, but there's a lot of Keanu in Wick, I think. One, that's why the movie was, whatever success it did have, I think it couldn't have been that way without Keanu playing John Wick. Keanu's, you probably hear this all the time, he's a workhorse. And like my day job is training cast members. I mean, I think we have one of the largest stunt companies on the planet, so we train everybody, you know, from the Marvel world, the DC world, the Bourne world, everything. And this guy just won't stay down. And he's got, Keanu's got this determination that is rare, even in the stunt community. And, you know, for professional athletes, it's rare. He has that I will not stay down. I will do this. He's the last one out of the gym. He just commits fully. And he has bad days like all of us. There's days he can't touch his toes. He's so sore, he's beat up, or he just has a bad day. But he won't quit. He'll just switch modes and go, okay, I'm here. What can I do that will improve me? And he listens, he's collaborative, like he's a freak. He really is. I don't know how he's still standing, actually. I mean, I'm brutal.
Yeah, we saw the obviously went on YouTube, the video of him on the three-gun range, which
yeah,
is
no,
frankly a little bit terrifying.
I don't think, most of the, like in John Wick, we call it porn. I like detail. So we have like judo porn, jujitsu porn, gun porn, car porn. With the sommelier talking, those are real terms that, you know, a gunsmith wrote for us. When, you know, we talk about cars, those are real terms that our mechanic department gave it. When we do the judo, jujitsu, those are real things. Just so the people that are in the genres or in the, you know, disciplines, you know, we want to impress them because it's so easy to phone it into movies. You got to remember, 95% of what most people know of a gunfight is learned from movies, and 100% of that 90% is probably bullshit. So we kind of went to real tactical. Like, people run out of bullets all the time. You have to do mag changes, and it's not easy. The reason Hollywood doesn't do, you know, when they reload the gun, because it's difficult and makes people look goofy. So the amount of time you have to go through that, it's not holding a gun, it's putting the fucking magazines in and aiming it and doing the thing and doing the flip. Keanu does every kind of reload imaginable. He's actually loading a shotgun in a shot with no cuts. Sounds fun, sounds easy. That's 5 months of shooting. I mean, the average guy can go in and maybe shoot 100 to 200 rounds a day at a range. Keanu was knocking off anywhere between 1,500 and 2,000 a day. So if you think about, we're training him like a tier one special force, again in competition, not to shoot people, but in competition, yeah. With shotguns, with loads. So we're like, we just made the commitment, like, Keanu, we're gonna see everything, so you might as well, you know, bring a lunch. And we got this guy Taron Butler, who's like, I forget what, a 14-time world champion. He's freaky, yeah. So it's just like, okay, this is where you're living, and it's this like desert range up in mid California. That's where Keanu stayed for about 4 months.
So what you're saying is, when the zombie apocalypse comes, Keanu's the guy you want to be with.
No, like when you see him on that video, like I try to competitively shoot too, and I train my ass off as much. It's just fun. I enjoy it. But when you see kind of doing what he's doing, that's not normal. That's full blown competition mode. Like, that's way beyond what a cast member. Like, he actually, he's like, just make me a competitor. We got this thing at 8711 is our company, and it's just like the best way to fake being good is just to be good. So we just got the best jiu-jitsu guys, judo guys, and gun guys, and we're just like, well, he's like, well, what's a choreography? And we're like, well, there ain't no choreography. You're just going to get good, and then we'll talk choreography. So become an expert at this, become an expert at this. And that's how he spent most of the year before I started shooting, just all martial arts and all shooting and driving.
And it's not just the action that's stunning in the film. There's some beautiful shots, particularly the Gianna hit, you know, in the bathtub. With the,
yeah,
where did
favorite
that idea
scene.
Come from? That was amazing.
Funny story. We had it a couple different ways. It was in a mansion. It was in her house. And just something was never feeling right. Like, I love Bernardo Bertolucci. I like Tarkovsky. I like Sergio Leone. I like, you can tell. You can tell by the movie. Rip them off all the time. I wanted to prove that you could make an action movie for a price and you didn't have to sacrifice how cool it is. You just needed commitment from the actor. So I think the action we felt good about. But I also had this little chip on my shoulders, like, look, I want to make a really pretty movie. And, you know, it makes, I love the early Bond movies. Mm-hmm. Where, you know, if I, being from the States, I, you know, I'd see him in St. Moritz and I'd be like, I want to go to St. Moritz. I want to go to Switzerland. I want to go to the Alps. I want to go to Bahamas. So I just want to do that with people, show people this magical world. And again, coming with the Wachowskis, visualization, every detail of how you paint the picture of the world is super important. But you can't do that with swishy cam and all that. So we try to do it like that. So anyways, our initial idea for the Gianna thing was in this mansion. It was through the rooms. And it was like, how many times have you seen somebody in a room? We're like, eh. We always knew we wanted this kind of weird. She had to leave the party and maybe it was in a bath. Because I love, if you watch the movie, I have this apparently fetish with mirrors. Sure. I love mirrors, and I got the last
Enter the Dragon.
Enter the Dragon, yeah. And what is it? The Last Tango in Paris.
Yeah.
The Bertolucci film with.
See, I was going to say Conan the Destroyer. So you're just operating a slightly higher.
Probably a little bit higher palette. They did this great shot where they did him talking to the girl, and it was all done in the mirror.
Yeah.
So you didn't have to do a reverse, and I thought that was fucking cool. So that's why we had those big mirrors in the Gianna scene. But anyways, it wasn't since. So Keanu was down in our office the other day, and he's like, he just got done working out, and I'm just sitting there, we're a little burnt, it's been a lot of jujitsu that day, and he goes, look, and we started talking, he's like, look, I see it, like, look, I got an idea, it's fucking a little wacky, it's a little wacky. I'm like, alright, I'm not gonna kill the Gianna. Alright, well, you gotta, that's the way it is. He's like, nah, she's gonna slit her wrist, we're gonna do it in this bathhouse. I picture she gets bashed, she's gonna strip, it's gonna be this confusing, we're gonna kind of put this tension in. And he talked me through it, and I was like, ooh, yeah, all right, that's pretty hardcore, yeah, it's a little creepy. And it just, I literally, he left after we had talked about it, and that's all, I couldn't get it out of my head. Then we started sketching, we started doing stuff. I'm like, call my production designer, it's like, bear with me on this. And we talked it through, and then we thought it was great. It was just fit the Wick world. It might have been a little hardcore anywhere else, but like, that's just the way these people live. And I thought it was a good way to show another side of mythology. Like, everybody in our world holds true to this. John, Santino, Julian. Like, that's what I keep saying. It's supposed to be a whole world with its own set of rules, and we thought that really fit. Cut to Kevin Cavanaugh, my production designer, who embraced this movie like no one, him and Dan Lawson. They're just like, we're going to paint a picture, which I think they did. He found this beautiful, beautiful set of ruins in Rome, right in the heart of Rome. And he's like, I'm going to build you a big-ass bathtub, and this is going to be awesome. We're going to do, it's like Barry Lyndon, we're going to do all candles, and we're going to do these two big mirrors. And like, so between Keanu coming up with it, me and my creative team sketching it and drawing it out, it kind of all came together. And then we had Claudia Gerini, who's like the only woman I think could have pulled that one off. Yeah, she was great.
Yeah. She was fierce.
It was incredible. Mm. Speaking of the actresses in the film, I thought Ruby Rose's Ares was really interesting. Where did the sort of sign language idea come from?
I always knew I wanted to do sign language. It's like, you know, our kooky subtitles and all that stuff. Yeah. I mean, again, we tried to be absurd. Like, you could go down the Tarantino route, like in Glorious Bastards, like the guy can speak three languages in a scene. Okay, we kind of did that already, so we're going to do that. I don't think I've ever seen sign language in a cool, in a hip action movie. And we actually have a friend, you know, a friend of a friend kind of thing, who's deaf. Mm. So we didn't want I did not want somebody born that way. I wanted to say, like, you know, Aries, she got shot in the throat. She couldn't communicate. She can hear, but she couldn't, you know, just sign language made sense. And I talked to this guy, and he did, you know, I was like, just, you know, if you had to, like, curse me out, what would you do? And some of the sign language was, like, awesome. I'm like, wow, that looks really, like, you could tell it's angry. And then, you know, we talk with, I mean, most people talk with their hands anyway, so I thought it was interesting. And, I mean, Aries was always written as a very small part. It could have been a stunt woman or just a badass, you know, action actor kind of thing. And we had just seen it. Kingsman had come out right after we did on the first one. We had seen Sophia Boutelle, razor blades on her feet and all that stuff. And like, well, and you could tell some of the lines they give, not in that movie, but in some of the lines they give those people, it's the guy over the guy or the girl over the bad guy's shoulder. It's got to be a sexy line. It's got to be something kind of silly. It's gonna, and we're like, yeah. So I sat down with Ruby and we had just kind of offered the job. I love to work as Orange and the New Black, and her career is just starting to take off. I sat her down in my office like, bear with me. Because I don't think she had seen the first movie when she came in. She just heard, like, yeah, it's really cool. It's John Wick. The director is this stunt guy. And I think that's all she knew. So I hit her like, look, I got this idea. I'm going to take away all your dialogue. And it was not taken well. She had the look of what the fuck on her face. And I was like, look, you could be just another girl saying the quippy line, saying, trying to be sexy, trying to say this, or giving shit to John. And it's always going to fall false, I think. But why don't you do sign language, and you'll be the first action actor or actress to do sign language. You can kind of flip them off. You can just, everything. Like, she has great face. She has great eyes, I think. So she's got that little, and she always looks a little pissed, you know? She looks like she's just got, not that she is, but she's got that cool look. And Ruby, when she talks, she's very expressive, you know, with her face. So that's what kind of set it off, just talking to her. And at the end of the day, to her credit, she trusted me enough to try it. And I don't know. I like it. I think people thought it was kind of cool. Something different. Mm. Made her stand out. Yeah.
Just on that point, I mean, do you have a sort of canonical number of languages that John speaks, or is that likely to increase in number three?
I think it would be funny if at some point he didn't know one. Not to set anything up, but I think that might be an interesting gag somewhere in the future. Well, spoiler.
I mean, where, if we can ask, do you see the story going from here in terms of, I mean, narratively, but also geographically? Have you already thought where this is going to end up?
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, I believe in circular things, but you have to cover a lot of distances. We'd like to expand the world just a little bit more, but then not just expand. I'd say if we were so lucky as to continue the series, I'd like to expand the world maybe another 25%, but then I'd like to go deeper into the world that most people already know, another 50%, so you can see where we would end up.
Because we still don't know exactly what the sort of impossible task was that he was set originally.
I'll leave that to maybe the TV show or something like that.
Is that gonna go ahead? Because obviously that got bandied around when you mentioned
it. The studio is tossing it about right now. I think it'd be... my pitch was, what happens to John Wick in the 5 years before he retired and the 5 years when he retires? Okay. That would give him plenty, like a plebeian's introduction to the world.
Yeah, so the season 3 finale ending with him killing the guy with a pencil.
Pretty much, yeah. I like pencils.
Yeah, the scene in that was particularly cool. I love the variance to the opponents where you had the busker and then the big guy, he kills the guy with the pencil. There's a real texture to the different fights.
Yeah, it's pretty much just a stack of notebooks like this from like 15 years of stunt coordinating, of being frustrated and not. The funny thing is, all the gun for the people, that's not new for us. Like, tactical gun work has been around for decades. And because of, some of us go out and shoot for fun, or for, you know, the zenness of, you know, it's just I look at it as a sport and another discipline that you should be good at for film or something. So we were around that stuff for a long time. And constantly, every job we were called to design, we tried to sell it to the director of the studio, the creative elements of the thing. Nobody liked it. They thought it was ridiculous. They thought it was this. I mean, not to spitefully shoot back. It's just, it's not really ours. It's just what operators or people in those worlds do. Mm. It's how they shoot. Like, people think we came up with a headshot. I mean, I don't know where or when. Nobody shoots from the hip. You know, and they don't do the one-handed John Woo thing. I mean, every special forces guy or cop out there shoots like, or John Wick shoots or tries to imitate what they do. Mm-hmm. So we tried to get that in film for years, and it's like, well, this isn't a military film, we shouldn't. I'm like, but it's really cool. And we can do this jiu-jitsu. And we mix the jiu-jitsu and the judo and the martial arts with it, of course. But, like, no one was buying. So when we got time to do our movie, we're like, we just thought it was easy. Like, we've already been choreographing this stuff for 3 years. We've got stacks of video. Let's just train Keanu and do it. And he goes, gun-fu. We were like, it was pretty funny.
It's the little moments, though, I think, that work so well. I mean, my favorite sort of sequence of film is when he and Cassian are walking along, just taking pot shots at each other, and no one notices.
Our silent gunfight. Yeah, that's a big laugh. We thought that was funny.
It was awesome. I love the elegance of his movements, just the little flicker upwards to the headshot, even after he's shot the chest, they're down, but just to make sure.
Everybody calls me on this one, but, like, I'm a huge fan of musicals. I grew up, like, I'll watch Sound of Music. I don't give a shit, you know? Like, I love La La Land. I think it's best fucking movie of the year. Yeah. Sorry, can I say those words?
Absolutely.
I think La La Land's great. Like, a musical show, like, I'll watch Singing in the Rain all day. Old Danny Kaye stuff. You know the technical prowess they had to have with those giraffe cranes coming around and doing those masters? It's phenomenal. It's absolutely phenomenal. You go watch The Kung Fu Hustle. I thought that movie was genius. You know, it's not so much that. I just appreciate live performances. I always like going to stage performances or musicals or anything like that just to watch the elements. There's no place to hide. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, where you sit in the audience. Early on, I got into martial art choreography. I was studying the Hong Kong guys and and it was from Jackie Chan scene, like, go watch dance, more like dance. I'm like, okay, I'll go watch a lot of dance. And I kind of get into it that way. But that's what, we were very conscious of that. Dave and I on the first one, and then myself and my stunt team on the second one. It's basically, I don't want to reach and say it's a musical, but it was meant to be a live performance based on dance. So when Keanu, like, in the museum fight, it's, I don't know if you noticed, it's classical music, it's Vivaldi. If you know anything about classical, it's from his Four Seasons. It's like somewhere. What we did is I had the composer rip out the percussion, and we timed the gunshots early in prep to the percussion. So when John's going, bump, 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 and so John's gun becomes a percussion in the sound. No one will pick it up, but for us, it was a challenge because it's not that easy to do. The composer's like, well, you know what you have to do. You'd have to choreograph it, and you'd have to edit, and your edit would have to be locked to the music. Like, you couldn't change. I mean, with music editors, you have a small variance in there, but basically the song, I mean, the music is the music, the composition. You can cut measures, you can kind of, you know, change the tempo a little bit, but you're pretty locked in. And we're like, yeah, fuck it, we got nothing else to do, let's give it a go, you know, like, well, let's challenge ourselves. And if somebody does pick it up, it'll be those two guys that go, holy shit, that's Vivaldi, that's the guns, the percussion. You're like, okay, cool.
Well, thank you very much. That has been absolutely fascinating.
Thanks.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, yeah. Lovely.
How was Keanu?
He was so good.
He was delightful, wasn't he? He was very animated. I think highly caffeinated. But he was punching the air and dooding and did alarming impressions of both John Leguizamo and and also Lawrence Fishburne. And then acted out the whole of John Wick 3, which was a pleasant surprise.
What he wants John Wick 3 to be, or what he knows John Wick 3 is going to be.
A little bit of both, I suspect. Yeah.
It seemed to be, wouldn't it be great if this happened and then this happened and, you know. Yeah, wouldn't it?
So John Wick 3 is probably going to happen now because it did pretty well, the US box office over the weekend.
Yeah.
The first movie did, this is weird if you look at this, the first movie only did about $85 million worldwide. Just enough, and just enough of a cult hit, and it wasn't that big a budget, to get a sequel greenlit. And now the sequels might do $100 million in the States, might, depends on the legs, obviously. It's certainly increasing. Maybe probably double what the first movie did. So hopefully we will get a John Wick Chapter 3, because as we're going to discuss, there's a lot of interesting stuff perhaps to come. And I loved the ending of this movie. But just to go back very, very quickly to Keanu, I think he's so animated on these press junkets, because I've seen a few interviews now with him where he's talking about John Wick Chapter 2, because he's found a character he loves.
I think he knows he's on something good, and he's actually having a really nice time as a result. He does seem like a strangely zen individual anyway. I feel like he finds his sort of center in even bad situations, but he is definitely having a good time right now, and some of that has got to be just confidence in the film, and presumably some of that is the knowledge that he could quite easily kill anyone who dislikes the film, because we've seen the training he went through for this, and he's ferocious. So, yeah.
Yeah.
Gives you an extra edge.
I love his sort of, his approach to, and James, you've done martial arts. I don't know whether the method that John Wick has for stab shooting people in the face, he has this really interesting thing, and obviously this is a podcast, you're not going to see what I'm doing, but he holds the gun very, very close to himself. He brings his arm in and he almost uses it, stabs it forward as he's shooting people two or three times. It's a very compact way of
using it. He's also got it's really delicate. You can see it a couple of times in the Rome sequence, and you can see it in the museum towards the end. There's a really delicate little flicker of the gun upwards for the headshot. So he'll shoot them once or twice in the chest and then just flicker the gun just slightly up to
there's
put them out.
An incredible efficiency of movement in the way he does everything. But I mean, if you see when I was on set, it's all coming back to me now, I do remember. The stunt coordinator came out to me, he's like, dude, come and have a look at this. And he showed me his phone. And he had on his phone the footage of Keanu Reeves on the gun range, which since then has actually gone on YouTube. And he was like, seriously, watch this guy. And you just watch him rampaging through that range, you know, with the shotgun and the assault and just gunning them down, never missing. You know, it's very, very impressive. And I know whenever you cover an action film, they always talk about how amazing their star is at everything. But he was like, literally, I can't tell you how many hundreds of people we train everyone on, like, you know, Bourne, Avengers, everything. They train all these people. And they said there is no one quite like Keanu Reeves. Like, he's a natural at it. Like, he could compete at this stuff. I think he mastered it. Just for me, the sequence when he's doing his sort of gun porn sommelier sequence with Peter Serafinovich, just the way he kind of, he holds the gun, he tilts it and he turns it and he locks it into his shoulder and then he flips up the side, and it's just so precise.
Yeah.
It's basically erotic.
Yes, it is. It's weirdly so.
Yeah. What were you on set for?
I was on set for the finale, actually. Not the flash mob, but the sort of Hall of Mirrors sequence.
Okay.
So, which is the art installation where he has his sort of showdown with Ares, where he's pursuing Santino. And the biggest challenge with that is it's mirrored surfaces everywhere. So you were talking, we're discussing there are no effect shots in this. Every frame of that is obviously an effect shot because they had to take the camera out. But as you said, they're very subtle ones.
Yeah, I think some of it's framing, so they just managed to avoid the camera as far as possible. But I was looking, so I basically spent last week before going to see this at a VFX festival and talking to VFX artists and everything else. So I was quite attuned going into it as far as I can be as a non-expert. And there is a very, comparatively very short VFX block of credits at the end of this film. And I think basically what they did was they added splatter.
Yeah.
They removed reflections. And almost, I think that's it. I think there's very, very little else. Yeah.
There's probably a little bit of it probably extending of scenery and stuff.
Yeah. And the only other thing that I think there might be two scenes that are rotoscoped. I don't think they had Keanu Reeves actually walking across the Piazza Navona. That looked a bit odd. But the only other thing I was wondering about when I saw it for a second time is the scene where he's in the car, the Carfu bit at the beginning. Now, we know from Keanu that he was in the scene where he backs into another car. That was him driving. When he gets physically knocked out of the car, that can't be him.
Because that's an insurance nightmare right there.
Yeah. So that, presumably, but I didn't get to look at it closely enough and long enough to establish if that's Keanu or a stuntman or a CG stuntman or what.
That sequence in particular I really like, because like the first film, and we talked a bit about this last night in the live podcast, but the first film has a sort of a serious edge but with an otherworldly layer beneath it. But it doesn't, you know, it's not what I would call hugely tongue-in-cheek. There's a little bit of that in there. Whereas this one, I mean, that whole prologue is pure farce.
Yeah.
And just Peter Stormare when he's like, he kills the guy with the pencil. Who fucking does that? You know, it's just like, it's hilarious.
Pencil.
Pencil. It's just, it's genius. It is absolute genius.
And you know, as Chad pointed out, the sort of the double bluff with the sound effects at the beginning and the film projected on the wall, that sets up what you're seeing, actually. It's basically a Buster Keaton movie. You know, it's that level of fluency with real stunt work that they're paying tribute to.
As I've said in the podcast before, I am a bit of a late breaking John Wick convert. It took a second viewing of the movie, the first movie, for me to really tap into its charms. But I love this movie from the off, and I bought into the ridiculousness of it from the off, and the fact that the opening sequence involves a bunch of people trying to kill each other with cars, and you're going, why not you? And then about 5 minutes into it, John Wick remembers he has a gun, and he just kills some dudes with a gun, and you're going, what? Okay, it's that sort of movie. It's the sort of movie where you will use a car instead of a gun because it's cooler and it's more fun and it's car foo and that's interesting. Okay, I'm on board. And the sort of weird otherworldliness of it is really doubled down in this movie. And I was very much on board right from the off. And the Peter Stormare cameo. Not only is the first of the movie's rather lovely Keanu Reeves reunions, because of course they had that incredible scene in Constantine.
Yes, they did.
Where Peter Stormare plays Satan. That was just really, really nice to me to see those two guys reunited. And also because he lived to fight another day, potentially.
Yeah.
And I really enjoyed that. Should we take some questions?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Can I have a question, first of all?
Okay.
It's about the gold coins. Now, we tried to get Chad to answer this, and he sort of hand-waved it, and that's fine, that's his right. But it is really interesting to me, because the gold coin is both a sort of a membership card.
Yes.
And an actual unit of currency. Like, you definitely pay more gold coins for a complete map of the catacombs underneath your target than you do for a drink at the bar, right? So there is an element of currency there. We know that one is worth more than the other. But a gold coin for two drinks at a bar, and they're not expensive drinks as far as we know. I mean, a gin and tonic, unless it's a super expensive gin.
It is Rome.
It is Rome, that's true. But it's not Iceland, you know. So that seems like either Common is a super generous tipper, or there's a little bit of sort of...
But what are the exchange rates like post-Brexit? We don't know this.
We don't know that. That is true. Yeah.
The price of gold coins in the John Wick world may have plummeted.
I feel like somebody's doctoral thesis has gotten off to a really good start with that. But no, I do think, I wondered if there was an element of, you know, your gold coin is basically your pass card, and then they figure out an amount and charge it to your account, or if your gold coin is, that's your gold coin and that's gone.
Maybe anyway. Each gold coin is slightly different. Maybe we don't see it, but maybe each gold coin
is denominational.
Yeah. Mm.
Yeah, it could be true. Could be true. And we do see that they're beautifully made by that dude who meets Ian McShane on the rooftop where Daredevil's foes hung out.
Oh, really?
In Daredevil. Do you remember?
Same rooftop. Did not
know. First, well, yeah. Well, it's opposite St. Patrick's Cathedral, isn't it? On Fifth Avenue in New York.
I love the way you act as if I'm completely au fait with the topography of New York. Yes, Helen. Yes, it is. Yeah. Yes, I know it well.
I'm pretty sure.
I spend my lunch hours there.
Well, isn't the Continental... It's not the Flatiron building, but I'm pretty sure there's a similar building in Daredevil at some point. You get buildings like that all the way through New York. Initially, I thought it was a Flatiron building at one point.
No,
but
I don't
it's
think
not.
So.
No. It's not. It's
the whole idea of the Continental and that subculture, it's not original in the... And we talked about this. It feels very vampiric. Mm. You know, it has that with the High Council and this sort of other... It feels like it's got an urban fantasy vibe to it, but it's hitmen instead of supernatural creatures, which is a really, really nice spin. But I love that they've thought so much of it through and just weirdly, I mean, we do a lot of these spoiler interviews, but Stahelski was fascinating.
He was fascinating.
I mean, just the amount of detail, and especially when we were talking about the music, the way that they cut the percussion out of Vivaldi and they use the gunshots to fulfill the percussion in the musical piece, so it's all timed. So that's a whole other level of choreography. So you're not just choreographing the action, you're then cutting it to music precisely and acting it out to music precisely.
There was an element of that in the first one in the nightclub, right? It was a similar sort of thing, but it's developed a bit more.
Yeah, that's like trance music. Yeah. It's slightly different.
The expansion of the Continental and the High Table and all the otherworldly mythology of the movie really, for me, sets this movie apart from all the other Jerry action movies, if we're going to lump Keanu Reeves in with the likes of Liam Neeson and Kevin Costner.
Yeah, it seems wrong because he looks about 60 years younger than them.
He looks 12. But
there's that picture of me, Helen, and Keanu. I have to get that in there. And he looks by far the youngest person.
Yeah, he does.
Yeah,
it's
really depressing.
It really is.
But it does set it apart. And, you know, when I first heard that John Wick was going to Rome, you just have this horrible feeling, Taken 2 went to Istanbul. It was just awful.
Yeah.
And movies that take their heroes on holiday, not that he's on holiday, it's a busman's holiday, if that, just don't work. But
this was more Mission Impossible 3 than Zoolander 2,
precisely,
though, in terms of visits to Rome, wasn't it? And I think it actually shared a lot of the same locations as Zoolander 2, actually, if you look at it closely. But it uses them much better.
Yeah, absolutely. We have one question from at D2Ren, Darren, I guess. Don't you think they've made John stupid in regards to him breaking rules? He wasn't that reckless in number one.
I think he's been through quite a lot.
Yeah.
I think he's entitled.
Yeah.
I mean, the guy blew up his house. I think it's entirely
fair
to shoot him in the face.
He breaks a rule right away.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He breaks lots of rules. I mean, he kills two members
of the high table in this film. So
yeah, they've got to be coming after him. I think the first rule he breaks, not accepting the marker, makes sense. Absolute sense within him. And then everything else flows from that. So maybe, you know, it makes sense. I kind of said this in the Keanu Reeves interview, but I genuinely think it's true. I think if everybody left him alone, there is a good chance this guy would lie down and die. Like, he's so depressed at the beginning of the first film. He just seems to have no particular lust for life left.
The dog helps. But the dog helps.
Yeah. The dog does help, yeah. But then if people keep coming and trying to kill him, he seems constitutionally incapable of lying down and dying, and he will keep killing them all.
See, it feels to me like it's muscle memory. Do you know what I mean? Like, him being a killer is so ingrained in that, as a person, he's moved on, but when they come at him, he just switches on.
Yeah.
I think you're absolutely right about it. There's a really interesting moment. I've only seen the film once. You've seen it twice?
Yeah.
Okay. So the moment when he rejects Santino's marker,
yeah,
he knows full well that is going to end in his death. I think the moment when he's in his house looking at the picture of him and his wife, or maybe it's just his wife, again, I've only seen it once.
Don't
yell at me. It's both, okay. I think he's expecting to die in that moment. And when he gets blown out of his house by the explosion, I think then you're right. I think then the muscle memory, the kind of, all right, okay, I didn't enjoy that. I was just expecting to die very quickly, and now it's on. But I think you're right. I think it's about a man who wants to die, but then won't let himself die when the chips are down. So killing Santino at the end of the movie in the Continental is absolutely a death sentence, and he wants it. But then as part of him goes, no, you can't kill death. I am death.
Yes, I actually started writing down all the things that people call him. So obviously Baba Yaga,
yeah,
the sort of the boogeyman. Lo Spettro, the ghost. Someone calls him death's very emissary, the devil. And someone refers to blowing up the priest's temple.
I need a better job title.
I know, seriously, these are really good. I'm not 100% sure I agree with you on Santino, because I think he still hopes that whatever friendship or whatever alliance they had that led him to give him the marker still sort of holds, that there's some kind of fellow feeling there. At least for a moment, I think he hopes that.
But the guy's fairly shifty.
When Winston says to him, why would you give a marker to a man like that?
Yeah.
You know, so he's obviously a really bad dude.
But then so was John, so maybe...
Yeah. And I like the idea that it ties him, that he helped him in some way with that impossible task, which is what got him out in the first place. I like the way they tied it together.
I thought that was really good.
But the idea about breaking rules, I think, goes back to John got out. He got out in the first place, and clearly he broke some rules and they overlooked it. In order to get out. Yeah.
Maybe, yeah. I just want to say something else about the marker scene, which is a bit irrelevant, but it really struck me during this film. Something about the marker scene made me think, if they are set on making a film adaptation of Sandman, which they persist in trying to do, I am now pretty much convinced that the only person who should be allowed to play him is Keanu Reeves. Something about that scene, if you've read Sandman, that's the dude that we need. So while Tom Hiddleston in Only Lovers Left Alive looks, acts and sounds exactly like Sandman, Keanu Reeves, I think, is Sandman, and no one else should be allowed to play him. Anyway, that was just a little aside brought to you from me. Thank you.
So the film then barrels through fairly quickly to Rome, and it has that really interesting, weird scene in the baths, which the BBFC have cut some seconds from.
All Keanu's idea, as we know from the interview.
The suicide, yeah. And then it barrels through all the different fights and all the different relationships, relationship with Cassian. And
he has that brilliant, almost computer game grammar to it when he goes back, and it's like mini-boss after mini-boss. It's like the huge fat guy and the busker, and you do feel it's relentless.
It is relentless, yeah.
I thought that was genius.
It's also something I've been saying for years. You can make a great video game movie if you don't bother making a game first.
Yeah.
Because that is the logic of this, but it doesn't have any of the, you know, nonsense that you get in video game movies.
Yeah.
Which leads to what I feel is probably my favourite ending of an American action movie in the last 5-10 years, which is John on the run, making that decision in the Continental to end Santino's bullshit once and for all, punch his ticket, knowing the consequences that will come to him. And it sets up, I usually have a problem with sequels that set up other sequels, but in this case, I'm on board, because I think the ending of this is fascinating. John Wick the world's greatest hitman.
On the run from everyone.
On the run from everybody else. Paranoid, not knowing who to trust, with the possible exception of Ian McShane, John Leguizamo, who you can finally hope gets something to do in John Wick Chapter 3, and of course Lance Reddick.
It's an interesting one, especially because Stahelski was saying that if they didn't get a third one, he'd be happy for it to end like that. He think that's, you can never have a happy ending. That could be
for me. This
ending
is a really good, it's really cool ending. It's
do you know what's interesting to me? That I had a radically different reaction to that ending the first and second time. So the first time I saw it, when John says to McShane or Winston, you know, tell them I'll kill them all. Whoever comes for me, I will kill them all. And he goes, yeah, of course you will. I read that the first time as John being a little desperate and McShane going, yeah, sure, okay, good luck with that, right? And being a little bit patronising. The second time I saw it, I saw, you know, what Stormare called the sheer fucking will of John Wick. And I thought, yeah, he is going to kill them all. And I thought Ian McShane was cheering him on.
He knows it.
And I don't know, I had genuinely a completely different reading of that scene both times. And I'm kind of interested to see what other people think of it.
It felt to me like a promise, not a threat. Like it was very much, this is a statement of fact, I will kill them all. And he's like, yes, you will.
Despite the fact that he is in the state that he's in.
Oh, he's, in fact, the one thing, if I were to pick up one thing about the film that bugged me, and that's that McShane has a really clumsy line where he says, there are only two rules. You don't kill people on the Continental and you don't break a marker. And I thought that was unnecessary. Do you know what I mean? We get it. We don't need it spelled out. It felt like a little bit of a clumsy bit of spoon feeding there, which I think we could have lived without.
I think we definitely needed the Continental ground scene because
we know that from the first
film. We needed spelled out again. And because of what happens to Adrian Palicki's character in the first movie, the minute John does that, I was fearing the worst at the end of the movie. I honestly was. You know, I thought this is going to be a Get Carter ending. But it sets it up really, really rather nicely, I think. And I'm fascinated to see if there is a chapter three where it can go from here. The idea of just a guy on the run, paranoid, is fascinating to me. Mm-hmm.
Killing everyone. And it's worth pointing out that the body count in this film is literally more than double the body count in the first one. The first film is the official body count that on YouTube is like 76, but Stahelski told me it's actually about 82 because they didn't count the guys who died in the SUVs. But this one, it's well over 170. I mean, it's about 176, I can't remember.
Which, of course, we're not condoning.
I'm absolutely condoning. I'm
against it. Murder is bad, kids.
Don't do it.
There's an infographic out there, and it's epic. So the next film, I can only imagine. I think the box office directly proportional to the body count at this point.
I loved all the action scenes in this movie. I thought the first one, the Rome catacombs one, where he's just assaulted by just an endless array of disposable henchmen, that went on a little long for me.
Yes, it did.
But everything else I thought was fantastic. And the movie has an underlying sense of mordant humour, which I really, really like. I loved it.
It's really
so
funny.
When he and Common are sniping at each other in the crowded subway corridor, there is an announcement over the tannoy to please report any suspicious activity, which I just thought is genius.
Yeah, there's so many little touches. And, you know, we haven't mentioned this, but Ruby Rose is fantastic as Ares. And I really liked the fact that she didn't speak, she isn't deaf, but that she signs. I know our editor, Terry, she was not a fan of that the female character had literally had her voice taken away. But I think it's different. I think it is, as Stahelski said, something you haven't seen before. And it enabled them to do more of those really funky subtitles they love so much. So if only for that, let's have more of that.
Okay, so we talked about the ending of the movie, which we all agree is excellent. We've talked about the film's sense of humour, very, very good. And I think without that sense of humour, the movie would just be really dour and really hard to take. Let's talk about some of the other characters as well, because John Wick dominates, doesn't he? And we'll talk also about some of your favourite action sequences. Let's start with the action sequences. What was your favourite bang, bang, shoot 'em up, bang, 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 people died type thing?
Ooh.
Technical term.
Very, very technical. I think it might be the catacombs for me, the sort of escape from the catacombs.
Oh, see, that's the one I think goes on a bit too long.
See, I like it. I was there for it.
I just wonder where everyone was coming from. It's just an endless array of disposable henchmen. It's like, you know, just go on, lie down, son.
Yeah, unlike all the other sequences, which of course.
But I did like the fact that he was prepared for it.
Yes.
And he knew the double cross was coming and they're setting up the guns and placing them along the routes.
Yeah, that's what I enjoyed, actually.
That was nice. It felt a little bit like Operation Wolf, the sort of 80s arcade game where you're just shooting random thugs as they jump out from behind walls. I it was really well done, but I agree. I think it's the only one where I felt my attention ever so slightly drift. But then obviously it's made up for because you go straight from that into his kind of running fight with Cassian, which is fantastic. I very much enjoyed that. Weirdly, when I was watching it, my favourite sequence was the kind of the silent pot shots.
That was fun.
My favourite bit because it was just loads of fun. But now, having been told that it was cut to Vivaldi, my favourite is absolutely the bit in the museum at the end because that's just genius.
Yeah. That's not a very long bit, the Vivaldi bit, actually.
No, it isn't.
I went back and watched it, but it was, it works. I kind of love it all. I loved the way that they just sort of edge closer to each other on the subway car. And they're both decent guys-ish by the standards of this movie, at least. And they're sort of waiting for the car to clear out a little bit before they go for each other. And it's that sort of unspoken acknowledgement that there are rules that I quite enjoy in that scene. I thought that was great.
Someone wrote in, I don't have a name here, sorry, but that they thought the reaction of the passengers to the massive knife fight breaking out in the tube, or the subway, rather, was slightly unrealistic, that people would be running for the doors. But I think in a situation like that, and I'm sure we've all been in a situation where someone has wigged out a little bit on a tube train, you tend to just kind of keep your head down and
freeze a bit
and watch.
I think that's probably the least alarming thing they'd seen on the subway that day. It's New York. Have you been there?
The subway is fine now. It's not the 80s, James. Jeez.
It's full of crazy people.
You're full of crazy people.
When was the last time you were on the subway in New York, James?
Well, funnily enough, when I went on the set of John Wick 2.
Did you see any knife fights? Anyone trying to kill each other?
I saw things you people wouldn't believe.
Attack ships on fire.
Exactly.
On the L train.
T-beams glitter in the dark by the, Houston shop.
What?
Houston. Houston. I said Houston. It's not Houston. It's Houston.
Houston. It is Houston.
Houston.
Yeah.
Near Houston.
I love that sequence. I think it's really, really cool. I'm intrigued that Common's character is going to presumably come back.
With a knife in his heart.
You can take that out. It's fine. Just,
He just needs to do it under medical supervision. It's going to be fine.
Yeah. He's going to need a really, really talented surgeon to sort him out. But he'll be fine. And he's got that look in his face going, I'll get you, John Wick. I'll maybe take a little while to recuperate. I also like the sort of montage where you see John Wick take on a whole bunch of different assassins. And I think that maybe points towards the craziness that Chapter 3 could be, where the threat could come from anywhere or anyone under any guise.
Yeah.
And just we talked about the doubling down of this movie, the doubling down of the craziness and the deepening of the mythology, and that it reminds me a little bit of the plot of The Naked Gun. Vincent Ludwig talks about anyone can be an assassin. And it feels like that's what this movie is. It's full of homeless people who are assassins, master assassins. It is full of buskers who are master assassins. People just walking along the street in sushi bars. They are assassins as well. So, have I just missed out on assassin training? Did I not go to that particular class at school?
Did you miss that day?
I must have missed that day.
It was such a good day. Yeah. Yeah. It was really useful for the sort of bell curve in the school because you could kill your enemies.
Well, of course, we're Northern Irish. We
always do.
We always do. We have a question from Ask the Movie Saint. What's the most gruesome death? But which one made you physically recoil the most? Personally, for me, it was either the pencil in the neck or when John held red shirt to the wall by a shotgun while he reloaded, then made his chest disappear.
Pencil. That's
it. Yeah, pencil.
It was the pencil.
It was the pencil. It's the gore on the pencil afterwards.
Ew.
Yeah.
Who does that?
Yeah, that's not... That wasn't... That no... Bad, no.
But good pencil scene.
It was a very good
Chekhov's pencil. You you introduce the idea that John Wick can
You introduce a loaded pencil, you know you're going to use it.
I believe it's leaded pencil. You introduce it and then you pay it off later on. Although there's only two guys, wasn't it? He kills with the pencil in the sushi bar.
Yeah.
Not three, because historically it was three.
Historically.
Yeah, but I like that. It's a very brutal movie. Very brutal movie. Lots of headshots in this film. There is an infographic, am I right in thinking? There's an infographic by a guy called George Hatzis, who did an amazing Kingsman demographic as well, where he broke down specifically the church fight into how many people Colin Firth killed, and he did the same here for John Wick Chapter 2. Incredibly fast work, it has to be said, but a lot of headshots. Over 100 deaths?
It's 170 something, I believe.
Wow.
Possibly 180 something, but yes, it's up there.
We have a question from at Laura Hotch via Twitter. I'm a bit confused about the hierarchy. Ian McShane's in charge of the Continental, says he's a bit independent from the high table, but yet he has a big ledger of debts. And he puts out the excommunicado on John Wick. So are the high table actually in charge, or are they just peacekeepers amongst the factions? It felt like McShane holds all the power.
Interesting.
Who's in charge here?
Well, they deliberately don't say, do they? I mean, it's Stahelski's very kind of keen to not demystify the mythology. But in my head, the various heads of the Continentals are kind of sort of regional governors, if you will. Mm-hmm. And then the high table is obviously they're representatives of all the various organized crime syndicates, and they govern as a whole. But you get the impression there's a level of local autonomy, and that in each city, the manager of the Continental is essentially the local capo,
and it's a place to go where everyone can go and rent and have a bit of R&R.
I think they're kind of independent for me, because I think, because, well, you have interesting things, don't you, because you have the reference to members of the high table having territories, so somebody is responsible for New York, but the Continental clearly is independent of that, and one gets the sense that the Continentals are not independent of each other. They clearly have a structure, and our impression certainly is that Winston is number one and Franco Nero is, you know, somewhere
Franco
else.
Nero. We haven't even mentioned Franco Nero. Amazing.
Is somewhere else in the structure. I do like it, obviously, if you notice McShane's sort of account number is 1111. So he's presumably pretty senior in the organisation.
Although the Continental in Rome was the first ever Continental. I know this because the producer told me on set.
Interesting.
So I don't know what that means. But yes, you're right.
But they could go back to, you know, in Middle Ages.
Exactly. Well,
right?
I think it did. Yes. Yeah. I think that's the impression. It's been around for hundreds of years. But when Keanu was spitballing his John Wick 3, he was saying, does it set the high table against the Continental? So yes, they would have a degree of separation.
Exactly. So he's seeing them as separate entities. So I think we can assume.
And he's John Wick. So, you know.
Yeah.
Oh, so yes. I mean, this is the thing. He obviously plays John Wick, but he has a fair amount of power in terms of where this story's going to go, I guess, as well. It's interesting. I really, really like the relationship between Winston and Jonathan. Mm.
How come if he's Jonathan, his name is shortened to John with an H? Come on, people.
Helen, I've looked this up.
That's a very valid point.
Jonathan with an H is a name. It's a Hebrew name. It's a name that exists.
Fine.
It is fine. It's okay. Jonathan Wick.
This is actually a thing, because I remember looking this up once and reasoned that the etymology of the name Jonathan, no H, and the etymology of the name John with an H are completely separate. They come from separate sources. They're not actually related to each other in any way.
From my cursory Google yesterday, I believe you're right in that they're not necessarily linked. But then again, people do this all the time. You know, people have little nicknames for each other that don't necessarily relate to the actual name.
But perhaps he is related to, or at least close friends with, Milo from The Last Boy Scout. And that's actually where it comes from.
Perhaps it is. But I love that relationship. I think it's a really interesting place for that to go. And I hope I think that Winston will I think Winston and Lance Reddick will turn up and start helping John Wick on the fly
I don't know if they can help.
Because he gave him a stay, didn't he?
Yeah.
A brief.
He gave him an
stay.
Hour.
Do you think that's as much as he can do?
I think so. But I would like to see Lance Reddick and the dog again. He was a good dog, you know. I would like to see that little double act developed a little bit further.
Amazing.
I don't know if they can help outright. I will be interested to see where that goes.
What do you think John Wick's dog's going to be called?
Bouncer.
I was genuinely intrigued by that. I love that's one of the threads that has not been resolved, and I am fascinated to see what his dog ends up being called, if indeed he has a name, you know.
What was the first one called?
Daisy, wasn't it?
Was it Daisy?
Yeah. Daisy, yeah.
Okay.
Is it bad that we knew that instantly?
That is, troubling on many levels.
So could this one be called Ridley? And perhaps he's just a massive Star Wars fan.
It could be that.
It could be that. Daisy and Ridley. Like Daisy Ridley. From the film Star Wars. Laura Hotch also had an addendum to her question, which was if there is a big bad in charge of the high table, which amazing actor from Keanu's past should it be?
Carrie Ann Moss.
Alex Winters, obviously.
Oh, that would be amazing.
William. Dude. Be excellent to each other.
Nick Nolte?
George Carlin returns triumphantly as Rufus. It could be amazing.
Sandra Bullock.
Sandra
Bullock.
My God. That's it. It's got to be Sandra Bullock. It's got to be Sandra Bullock.
Yeah. Make it happen.
There you go.
Make it happen.
And the whole of John Wick Chapter 3 is him on a bus. It'd be amazing.
Well, I was genuinely...
A lake house reunion. Oh, my God.
I was genuinely thinking, like, how do you get out of Manhattan in an hour?
No one looks at the buses.
Don't they, though? Because all the homeless people might be around the bus station. Everybody looks at the buses. I mean, just to get out of that part of the middle of Central Park and to one of the train stations is a long walk, you know? And he hasn't got that much time. And, oh,
he has to pick
I'm
up
really
his
stressed.
Car. Before he does anything else, he has to pick up his
but
car.
But his car is definitely on the other side of the bridge, right?
Well,
I mean, his
hour.
Car is not in Manhattan.
But he's got an hour.
Yeah, I know he has an hour, but that's not a long time, is what I'm saying. If it's, like, it's the middle of the afternoon, it seems to be busy, there's traffic, you know?
Uh-huh. Jetpacks.
And he's limping.
And he has a dog, so, like, some buses and stuff aren't going to let him on.
Presumably he'll get in a cab.
But can he trust any cab drivers?
Yes. But if he keeps switching cabs, or maybe...
But that takes up time.
Maybe he'll get an Uber. Maybe there's a Continental-style Uber.
Oh, he can definitely trust an Uber, yeah.
Yeah. I'm just saying, okay, I think he can make it there in time, because he has an hour, but all the assassins in the world, and it seems that they're all in New York at this point.
Some of those people were just people whose phones were ringing.
That's
probably.
It. And they were just looking at him in a really sinister way.
Yeah. Well, that's because he's just paranoid at this point. Like, he doesn't know who he can trust.
Uh-huh.
I think is the idea. But the other question is, if he gets there after 55 minutes, will Leguizamo be able to give him his car?
I think for
And does
old,
his car run?
For old time's sake. Has he had time to fix it?
Christmas, 2030.
It was written off. That looks like a bit of a fixer-upper to me. But I think even if he doesn't give him his car, he can at least give him
a
runaround.
This may say more about me than it does about the film, but the thing that really bugged me about that beginning bit is he's clearly going to get into a fight with these people. They're clearly going to start shooting. He finds his car, and then what I would have done was kill everyone, then gone and got my car. And he gets in his car. It's like, your car's about to get wrecked. There's no way this car doesn't get wrecked. Don't get in the car.
As a non-car person, right, when he started driving his car into other people's cars, I thought, aha, maybe he's just taken the wrong car and then he'll go back and get his car once he's killed them all. And I didn't actually realise for a little while that he was in his car.
And he destroyed his car.
And he destroyed his car.
Honestly, it was just like, oh,
beautiful car.
Well, again, an endless array of disposable henchmen attack him with a car. Just shoot him, guys. It's so much easier. He's there.
I mean, that doesn't work either, though. We've seen it.
Where can I get those bulletproof shirts?
Oh, I want a bulletproof suit. Well, I must have a bulletproof suit.
The suit was pretty cool. Tactical lining.
That's just genius.
Do we want to see Sarah Finowich back as a sommelier?
Yes.
I think that was a lovely sequence, and I thought it was great. I don't know if I need to see the same sequence again, but
well, he needs to be tooled up, John Wick. Oh, I mean, he's not going to.
But he can't go to Serafinovitz because he's part of the Continental.
Ah, yes, that's right.
He's excommunicated.
He'll have to. If only there were places in America where you could, you know, buy guns and, you know, like over the counter, then he'd be fine.
Yeah, well, I guess he's stuck then. Oof.
Yeah, I mean, that would just be silly.
I wonder if we'll get the cop Jimmy back again. You working again, John? Can't be a John Wick movie without him asking that question. We've got a question from Mike P. Williams, who asks, while this film is satisfyingly pro-dog, it feels anti-cat. Please discuss in detail the merits of cats.
There are none.
And actually, I'll tell you what, I saw another film recently called Elle, which absolutely illustrates that cats are useless. So, don't get a cat, get a dog.
Wow, three very dog people here.
Very
Sorry.
Dog, much woof.
Yeah.
I don't mind, cats are okay, but
they're fine. I don't understand why you bring something into your house that treats you with contempt, as standard. If I'm going to,
I mean, if you want that, you get married.
Exactly.
Oh, there we go. Boom, boom, boom.
If I'm going to feed something and like take it to the vet and stuff, I want some like unfiltered adoration is what I want.
Yeah,
so
I'm
maybe
with
this
you.
Says something unhealthy about me. I want to say something quickly about
you can't.
Keanu Reeves.
No.
Noises when he gets hit. Did anyone else notice this?
No.
He just makes amazing noises when people hit him. There was a sort of a yart noise, which was incredible.
A yart.
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 And that's a sort of snurf.
Snurf. Nerg.
They, genuinely, listen to this next time you watch the movie. The noises are amazing.
So what you're saying is they're vocalizations of those fantastic kind of comic book.
Yes.
Block sound effects.
Exactly. It's like, Schmurgle! It's like 1966 Batman.
Captain America, I command you to wank.
What?
You not seen that?
No.
There's an amazing,
what are you talking
there's,
about?
There's an amazing panel. There's an amazing panel from a Captain America comic where this bad guy, and I don't remember the bad guy, is going, Captain America, I command you to, and then he's interrupted by Cap, who throws a shield at him, and his shield hits a bad guy in the face. And the
noise effect
the,
is...
Yeah, the onomatopoeic effect is wank.
Because, so, of course, Americans don't know what that traditionally what that word means, which is why Spike got away with it in Buffy for so long. He used to call people a wanker people all the time, that. And they didn't
it
know.
It is funny when you get that, because with Avatar, we had that. Remember the last Airbender? And they had lines in it when they would say, like, Fire's tribe are the biggest benders. And no one could understand why in British cinemas, like, loads of people were just pissing themselves laughing, because it just said incredibly flat. And they had no idea that it was a British slang.
Dev Patel must have been trying to say something. Seriously.
Really?
Well, no. Come on. I don't think we've talked enough. We've got a few minutes left. I don't think we've talked enough about how awesome Keanu Reeves is in this role. And I know that you guys are deeply in love with him, having
so
met him
in love.
And having had him rub his stardust on your faces.
Oh, he did.
But, you know, I wrote about this in my review a little bit, that his career since The Matrix has been somewhat overshadowed by Neo. Mm. And he's made movies, but not that many if you look back at his. He's very, very choosy. And in that time, obviously, he's made the likes of Constantine, which I think is fantastic.
I think it's great.
And, there's a film ripe for rediscovery and championing. But I don't know if he found a role that really he connected with the way that he connected with Neo. And now I feel he has found it. And yes, people will still criticize his acting and they'll still criticize his delivery. That's his voice, guys. That's all he has to work with. But I think he's great in this role. And this could have been, and I've said it a little bit before about how this could have been just another generic action sequel. And the first one could have been just another generic action movie. And this could have been just another generic action character. But there's something that he brings to it. A cool, a suaveness, a sophistication. And he looks fucking excellent.
Yeah, he
all
really
the way
does. Yeah. I'm a, you know, a lifelong pretty much Keanu apologist. I genuinely like I
you know where the bastard sleeps.
I started really getting into movies, I was getting into like Bill and Ted and Point Break and that whole era of Keanu. And I don't think anyone who is as talentless as his critics sometimes suggest makes so many great movies by accident. That's not a thing that happens.
He's fantastic.
You have to give him credit for these things.
I mean, yes, he was terrible in Dracula, and he's had a few unfortunate roles.
No, but Dracula is terrible.
He fits in
with the terribleness of everything around him. It's kind of wonderful. I enjoy it as well, but on a maybe different level than maybe I should.
No, you're both wrong.
No,
it is the cat of movies. It is just an utterly pointless thing. No, I'm kidding. I love cats.
Cats is terrible, but Dracula's
Cats
is
musical is terrible.
He's literally sitting here wearing a necklace made of severed cat heads. It's important you know this.
Jellicle cats, shove it up your bollocks.
Do you remember the movie Sleepwalkers? Where they were like
Stephen King's Sleepwalkers.
Yes. Yeah, where cats were the only things that could save us from these vampiric were creatures.
Which is weird because Stephen King's a dog guy.
Yeah.
Oh, and they could save us from the mummy. So I guess they're useful if you're being attacked by mummy or those were creatures.
What were they called? Anyone? Anyone? I know Enya sang the title music, but that's basically all I remember.
But you look back at Keanu's career and he has Point Break, as Helen pointed out, Speed. He has the Matrix movies, of course, first one. Probably a little better than the others. And then he's got this role as well. That's four cracking action hero roles in a career. And I would add Constantine to that as well, because I really love that film. That's five in a career. How many other actors can name that?
Yeah.
Can match that?
I mean, and those are not his only good roles, but those are his... I mean, those four action classics, really. That's stunning. He's just consistently underrated, and even when he is, you know, one of the biggest stars in the world, he should be bigger. So I love him.
Let's talk about Lawrence Fishburne, because the film starts with a Keanu reunion with Peter Stormare, but then it builds to the reunion of Neo and Morpheus. Interesting that. What do you make of that relationship with the Bowery King and John Wick?
It didn't play out quite the way I expected in some ways. I think I like the whole idea that John Wick had left him essentially not quite for dead, but left him behind on the basis that you can either stay alive or chase me. You can't do both. And I thought that was a really nice kind of setup. But I don't know. I was hoping for maybe or expected a bit more collaboration between them. And I was it was quite interesting that. That Fishburne's Bowery King was as tough on him as he was. I thought that was quite fun in a way. It was unexpected, but it kind of worked.
Can I point out something that I really enjoyed about this film that I think is a flaw of the first movie? Is that John Wick is presented throughout the movie, the first movie, as an unstoppable killing machine, the Baba Yaga, the hitman that all hitmen fear. And yet, twice during the film, he has to be bailed out by... Marcus, isn't it?
Yeah.
I think I said Marcus earlier on. I think that's what I called John Leguizamo's character. People were probably screaming at me saying I'm wrong. I am wrong. Marcus was Willem Dafoe's character. And he's bailed out twice by Marcus. In fact, during that classic John Wick bit of dialogue, you know, I'm thinking I'm back. He's tied to a chair about to be killed with no possible hope of escape. In this movie, though, that doesn't happen. He does. You know, he is on the run. He does need people's assistance, but at no point is he chained up. At all points, he's on the offensive and he's able to fight back when people attack him. And I really, really like that.
Last time he was out of practice. This time he's loosened up. You know, he's done his warm up.
So, he's got his eye in.
Yeah, he's fine.
And hopefully that Fishburne relationship will carry on as well. Did you see, very, very quickly, the picture of, it was at one of the premieres for John Wick Chapter 2, of Fishburne and Keanu and Carrie-Anne Moss together?
Yeah.
And it gave me chills in a way I honestly wasn't expecting. So maybe Carrie-Anne Moss should show up, but Sandra Bullock should be the head.
Should be the head.
Should be the head of the high table. And if that doesn't happen, Chaz Stahelski, and I know you're listening to this podcast, then it is frankly, sir, a dereliction of duty.
You're calling out the director of... John Wick.
Yeah.
Yes, the man who has...
The professional stuntman
who has an array of professional stuntmen.
Yeah, working for him and with him. Yeah.
30-year
the one who's a competitive level shooter as well.
Yeah, and a black belt.
That's the guy you're calling out, just to be clear.
Yeah. See,
Next week's podcast will be hosted by someone alive.
I didn't have all those facts to hand when I said that. I just say this. Fake news! yes. Chad Stahelski, an apology. When I said that a couple of minutes ago, I'm really sorry. Please don't kill me. Right, is that it? Have we said enough about this movie?
I don't think we can ever say enough. But
we've probably bored everyone to death by this point. So.
Yes, we should. And we should go off to see the film that will form the basis of our next spoiler special as well.
Yeah.
We are literally going to screening now of Logan, which will be our next spoiler special with director James Mangold.
Yes. This is, of course, the prequel. Ted Theodore Logan. nothing connected to Wolverine at all.
Wouldn't that be an interesting wrinkle? As ever, thank you for listening. That spoiler special for Logan will be out March 6th, I think. Keep your ears peeled for that one. Also, the regular podcast is out every Friday, so do listen to that. If you don't already, do subscribe to it on iTunes and do leave us nice comments, not nasty ones, on the reviews section as well. Right, that is it for our John Wick Chapter 2 spoiler special. It is goodbye from Helen.
Toodaloo.
It is goodbye from Jimbo.
I'm thinking we'll be back.
And yes, we will be back, hopefully for John Wick Chapter 3 in a couple of years' time. It's goodbye from me as well. Thank you for listening. I'm off to stay in the Continental.